Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu.
I'm Tiziana Dearing, and I want you to picture it. 250 years ago, on this day, it's a dark, late winter night in Boston, and shots ring out on what was then King Street. The events of that night would later become known as the Boston Massacre. Here with us to tell us the story is Peter Drummy, librarian of the Massachusetts Historical Society. Peter, welcome.
Thank you.
And Serena Zabin. She's a professor of history at Carleton College and author of the book, The Boston Massacre, A Family History. Serena, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you.
All right. So, Peter, I want to start with 10 p.m., March 5th, 1770. In that moment, bring us there. What's happening?
Well, stepping back.
Start us there and then step back.
Okay. Yeah. Starting there, that night, a sentry is in front of the custom house.
Okay.
The building, not a public building, but a house taken over by the people enforcing customs regulations in Boston. There's a sentry guarding it. And there's been friction in the town that night between townspeople and soldiers. The soldiers are throughout the town. And a boy, an apprentice, has been hit by the sentry earlier in the evening. A crowd gathers. The sentry is threatened. He calls for assistance. There is a part of the garrison of Boston is nearby. So a file of soldiers, an officer, and eight soldiers march down what we call State Street, King Street.
I can hear their boots on the cobblestone streets.
There's
right?
snow on the ground. It's very dark. There are no street lights in Boston. So they're coming down to the assistance of a fellow soldier. They gather right at the steps of the custom house and sort of form a little half circle around him to protect him. People are throwing things, shouting at them. The church bells have been ringing. This is the signal, fire alarm signal, but it's also calling people out in the street. So more people are gathering there. A crowd gathers. It's not certain how large that is. 50 or 100 people, maybe several hundred people. They're young men, almost for the most part, and teenagers in some cases. There's back and forth between the soldiers and the civilians that
you
have
mean,
gathered.
Like shouting
there.
Back
shouting
and forth.
Back and forth. People are calling them the damned lobsters and also taunting them. There's taunting fire. Why don't you fire? That is fire, fire alarm, and now fire, you know, fire upon people. Either by accident, someone knocked down and his musket is fired by accident, or is simply angered by being hit by the things being thrown. Fires in many shootings. There seems to be contagious shooting. So over a period of at least several seconds and maybe a slightly longer period of time, there's a ragged volley where all the armed soldiers fire. And they were so close to the people who are in this crowd that even though probably only eight people fire their muskets, more people are killed on the spot, fatally wounded.
How many, Peter? How many are killed?
So four people are killed or fatally wounded right there, and a fifth victim survives for about a week
and
then dies.
So I want to pause there for a minute, and I want to turn to Serena, because Serena, in your book, you call it a family history. And there is a different kind of intimacy in the way you talk about the relationships between the people who might have been on the street that night and how we tend to think about it. So now Peter has actually painted for us a very intimate scene of people up against each other and talking to each other and taunting each other. Round it out from your perspective from the book that night.
Right. So all these people who are on the street, and we have to imagine this is a pretty small square, right? Right there in front of what's now the old State House.
Where that circle, mosaic, is now on the pavement.
Mostly.
Roughly.
Yeah. It's been moved. Okay. But, about there.
Oh, man, I didn't know that.
Oh, sorry. Yeah.
No, it's okay.
It's true. But what I think we really have to remember is that all these people on the street knew at least some of the others. So one thing that happens that night, one of the soldiers who marches out in that file had just recently, in a few previous few months had married a local woman. Another mm-hmm. one of the men who walks out knows a number of the people in the crowd, and so much so that one of the guys in the crowd comes up to him and says, "Hey, what's going on? I'm not sure. Can you tell me about this?" So although they are gathered in a semicircle, as Peter said, there's actually a lot of civilians who are pushing very close to them, talking to them, chatting to them, asking them questions.
So it's very interpersonal.
It's very interpersonal.
All right. And I'm going to ask you a question that I'm – and then after you'd answered, I'm going to take it back to Peter, because in the book, you use a picture that Paul Revere had created based on someone else's picture of that night that's quite famous that doesn't tell the story that way.
Right. So Revere tells a story in that incredibly famous engraving of soldiers on the one side and civilians on the other side and this big cloud of gun smoke that separates the two of them. But that's not the story at all. In fact, both literally and figuratively, everyone's all mixed up together. So what I think we have to do is not let Revere just tell us that story. It's almost the only one we know.
Now, Peter, you are the librarian of the Massachusetts Historical Society. My sense is you've got a pretty good grasp of how art and literature after that event did shape, almost like, I hate to use the word, but almost like early propaganda.
Oh, no, that's a word to use.
Great.
That's
so
exactly
talk about that.
Right. This is, it's important to remember, there is, in Boston, there is, we call them the Sons of Liberty. There's this organized resistance, a semi-secret organization, resisting royal authority here, very much pushing back. This is a small seaport which depends, many people depend for their livelihood on going outside or around government regulation. A lot of smuggling going on. So these soldiers are here to support the regulations, support the customs officers. They're not police officers, but they're here, a military force acting as, in some respects, as a police force would be.
So sort of serving as domestic law enforcement.
Yes, except
around
that,
money.
Yes, but very constrained. But to the people involved in this resistance, this is arbitrary power from outside. This is a standing army being placed upon the population of this small town. Serena, very interestingly, describes that in a really new and interesting way. But as far as the propaganda of it, Revere's engraving and the copies that are made from it, the copies that appear in newspapers, the newspapers themselves, this is a society where there are many people who are literate. This is a Bible reading commonwealth, the province of Massachusetts Bay. So people are reading newspapers. They're reading the pamphlets that are published in the aftermath of this event. And all of this literature and all these images are designed to influence public opinion, either to be sympathetic to the government, the royal government, but it's the government we're living under here, or to sympathetic and supporting the population.
So people are kind of picking sides there.
Yes.
Okay. So Serena, I grew up in the state of Michigan. And apologies to my history teachers from when I was younger if they feel I'm oversimplifying. But where I grew up, the story we got told was there was a Boston Massacre and somewhere in there some people dumped some tea and then Paul Revere rode and we had a revolution.
Yeah.
But neither you, I think, nor Peter would mash it all up together like
that.
Do you want to stretch that back out for us?
I would be happy to. So in 1770, nobody thinks that there's going to be a revolution. And
that's only 6 years before it really starts to get wild.
It's true.
Yeah.
You know, and really, and only, you know, 3 years and a bit until the tea and, you know, and the acts that follow from the dumping of the tea, which really does, I think, push people much, much farther towards separation. But in 1770, as Peter said, they're living under a royal government, and those Sons of Liberty really are opposed to the way that the government is administering its empire. But it doesn't object to the idea of being in the British Empire. Most people actually are really thrilled to be part of the British Empire in 1770, largely because the British had just kicked the French out of most of North America, and they feel like they're on top of the world. So they're all very proud to be British.
And according to your book, marrying each other and going to church together and going to jail together and living daily life all mashed up together.
Absolutely. So it's true that while people did think of the idea of an army as something scary and a thing that no good government should do, soldiers themselves are actually quite attractive. They're less attractive to men, like the Sons of Liberty, who are all sons, right? But they're very attractive to women.
Yeah, Peter, this made me think of all those Jane Austen novels, right?
This perfect example of that. The other thing to just reinforce this point, when these soldiers come in the fall of 1768, so by March 5th, 1770, they've been here for about a year and a half. There's an artist, Christian Remick, who paints a view out into the harbor of the troops being landed. And one of the copies we have at the Massachusetts Historical Society, emblazoned above the view is Magna Carta. People here are thinking that their rights as subjects of the king descend from Magna Carta. And their resistance is along constitutional English constitutional lines. Not these aren't revolutionaries, as Serena said. They're people who are thinking that they're at a distance from England, but they're equal members of that.
So, Peter, in a word, what changed? After that, something changes. We're dumping tea in 1773.
Yes, but not the next day. In fact, what happens is probably the most hated figure, the royal governor, royal governor, Thomas Hutchinson, who is a local man. He's not someone, again, brought in from outside. He acts in the aftermath of this in a kind of responsible manner. He immediately withdraws the troops, not from Boston, all of Boston, but out of the town, out to the castle, what we call Fort Independence today, connected to the mainland, but then an island in Boston Harbor. He cools things off. So it's not the Boston Massacre and next day the Boston Tea Party and next day Paul Revere. What it is this explosion and then people pulling back and cooling off as the events take place here in Boston, the Boston Massacre. Parliament is discussing the withdrawal of the taxes.
Interesting.
Right at that same moment. Okay. And the communications makes that very difficult to know what's going on.
Okay. And so then, Serena, as this this wasn't the word you used, Peter, but it made me think of it. Sort of this contraction starts to happen after the Boston Massacre. One of the things your book says is, okay, but marriage is marriage and families are families and babies are babies. So it gets messy.
It gets very messy. In fact, amazingly, after the shooting, there are still as many marriages that happen between locals and soldiers as there were before. So it doesn't actually stop that sense of connection between soldiers and civilians. But it does get messy because when soldiers leave, right, when they're redeployed, then families have to decide what they're going to do, especially these newly created families, right?
And on balance, what do they do?
So they do all different sorts of things. So sometimes men decide they're going to stay with their new families. They desert, right? Sometimes women decide that they're not going to go. And so they do what we call self-divorce. They stay. And then often with their children. And then sometimes, of course, they do go with them. And so then I think about parts of Boston, people of Boston families that are then traveling around the British Empire, part then of the British Army, well before the Tea Party, well before Lexington and Concord.
All right, Peter, we have literally 30 seconds left. In that last 30 seconds, what's the one thing you would most want people to understand about the Boston Massacre?
There are new things to learn about it, but the other thing that we haven't discussed is essentially these soldiers who did the shooting received essentially fair trials by the civilian authority of Boston. And that, I think, is something we as Bostonians can be really proud of in our history.
That makes me feel proud to hear you say that. All right, Peter Drummy, librarian for the Massachusetts Historical Society, thank you for being here.
My pleasure.
And Serena Zabin, history professor at Carleton College and author of the book The Boston Massacre, A Family History. Thanks to you, too.
Thank you.
And Serena will be appearing at a number of book talks over the next few days, and the Massachusetts Historical Society has a special exhibit commemorating the 250th anniversary. You can find all of it on our website, radioboston.org.